our joint work with Dycroft, Glucos, and Nitsky. And I understand that you'll hear a bit more about this also from a talk that Robert will give later on this week. The audience here has mixed background, and therefore I will try to say aspects which are, perhaps some aspects which are not familiar to one group or the other, and hopefully some aspects which are familiar to both. So to set the stage, I want to talk about what we're trying to do, and in the physics language to mathematicians, we are trying to understand what is quantum gravity. And this question has occupied physicists for a while now, and there's yet no definitive answer. And we have made a lot of progress in this to try to answer exactly this question in the context of string theory. And this is somehow going to be related to one of my main motivations of this talk, to find examples of what quantum gravity is in a simpler situation. String theory came along and gave an answer to what quantum theory of gravity is in terms of a perturbative expansion, which is not a definition of this theory, but more like a weak coupling expansion of the theory. And it ended up having some very beautiful structure, and beautiful things came out of it. But also some strange things came out of it. One of the strange things was that it didn't just have gravity, it had gravity plus infinitely many more particles. And it had not just four dimensions, but 10 dimensions. So there are many strange things that came out of string theory, which we were not asking for it to be there, but it came out. And later we found that these extra things were good for string theory, like extra dimensions, got to be useful in the context of black hole entropy or in the context of ADS-CFT correspondence, or this and that, so that's one good application. So we have some nice reasons why these extra dimensions come, and why these extra particles are there, but that was not the original goal of quantum gravity. The quantum gravity was trying to understand just one metric, try to quantize it, that simple idea. Somehow did not find this reasonable answer in the context of string theory. Now, there are some contexts in which that more or less does happen, and this is the context which I want to talk about, where basically you don't necessarily get the usual gravity, but some kind of a simplified gravity. And what constitutes calling it a simplified gravity will become clear from the context of the examples I'm going to be giving. But roughly speaking, it is a theory in which the metric degree of freedom, which is a symmetric tensor, two-tensor object, is somehow replaced by some kind of a form. Yeah, G-mu. G-mu is a tensor. It's a symmetric tensor. Right, yeah, fluctuates in all directions. That's just the metric of space-time. There's some echo. Sorry? Yeah, that's what I think. I don't have a control. That's a good question. We'll come to those. It's not terrible back there? Okay. So what is meant by this, and why is it useful and so forth, comes basically from examples. And that example is what really motivated this idea of topological M-theory. So these examples involve gravity theories in different dimensions, and in particular in dimensions 3, 4, and 6. And somehow the special one in 7. Now, it might not appear as anything special on the on this board as far as the dimensions, but these came out from string theory, as I will try to explain, especially this one in dimension 6 is what has become known as topological string theory. The dimension 4 makes close contact with another approach to try to quantize gravity in the context of loop quantum gravity, which has also the same flavor of replacing a metric degree of freedom with some, in that case, not just a form, but a gauge field. Loop quantum gravity. And in dimension 3, I'm going to explain this a little bit more, and in dimension 3, there's already another approach to try to quantize gravity, and that was an approach more than a decade old by Witten and others, which tried to replace the gauge theory, gravity by gauge theory of SL2 of some, with some coefficient here, complex or whatnot, gauge theory. And more precisely, SL2 Chern-Simon theory. In dimension 7, there was this concept, there was this relatively recent work of Hitchin, which does not describe a quantum theory, but a classical theory of metrics on a 7 manifold. So he writes down an action whose extrema give rise to Jito holonomy metrics on 7 manifolds. So this, I will call this just the Hitchin theory. So he talked just about the classical theory, but you could try to imagine perhaps quantizing that theory. In all of these examples, as I will review, forms play crucial role and not the metric. Metric is a derived concept. You can kind of rewrite it in terms of forms. Now, why is that a progress? Well, a priori, it's not clear why that should be viewed as a progress. In physics, we are familiar with gauge theories more than with theories of gravity, so writing things in terms of forms somehow has a better chance of being quantum definable. That's one, perhaps, hope one could have in the context of trying to define the quantum version of these theories. But really, the reason we are doing this is that that's the way it actually came about. That's the way string theory came about with this object. That's the way this naturally appears in four-dimensional special magic about four-dimensional metrics. And similarly in three dimensions, so there seems to be something very special going on, which needs a deeper explanation. Instead of trying to give more motivation of why we are studying this, I think it perhaps it's best to say what these theories are in a bit more detail, and how they might be connected with each other. So the basic aim is first to try to describe these one by one, what these theories are, and then try to say why this seven-dimensional one plays a special role and perhaps unifies it and reduces in the various different cases to all the other ones. This just pulled up. Okay. So I'll start with dimension 3. So in dimension 3, we have, if you take a triplet of one forms, orthonormal frame, if I denote them by E, if you want the label of a triplet by I goes from 1 to 3. You could think about this as transforming under the SO3, adjoint of SO3. You could also denote the connection, the spin connection by A, it's an SU2 connection. then the Einstein's equations can be written in terms of these in a different way. It could be written, first of all, as E being covariantly constant with respect to the connection A, and also the curvature of this gauge field plus the cosmological constant times E, which E is zero. So this is the rewriting of Einstein's equations in three dimensions. So it was noticed by Witten that this can also be viewed as solving a particular Chern-Simon as a classical solution to Chern-Simon action. So you write the Chern-Simon action called A tilde. So the usual Chern-Simon. And here I'm normalizing, absorbing lambda and calling it 1 in this normalization, where A tilde is a connection, one form, which belongs to, well, one of three groups, either SL2C, ISO3, or SG2 cross SG2, with some norm, depending on what the sign of lambda is, cosmological constant is. Lambda less than 0, lambda equal to 0, and lambda bigger than 0. So when you write these in terms of the components of the two SG2D algebra elements in it, you will find you get these equations out of varying this. So in particular, this basically has the form when you write in terms of components as something like E wedge F plus by absorbing back in lambda as E cubed. So when you vary with respect to E, you get the equation F plus lambda E squared is 0. And when you vary with respect to A, you get this equation. So in this way, the three-dimensional gravity was rewritten in terms of a theory of gauge theory, in this case, the SL2 Chern-Simon theory. Connection on the three manifolds. So take a three manifold with this structure grouping SL2C. So the group is not the group is not SO3. It's SL2C. Or ISO3 or SU2 cross SU2? No. So the connection, so there's a piece of it, so there's SU2 part of it, is really going to be related to the tangent bundle. So in other words, when you decompose this, so SL2C can be viewed as, in terms of algebra, there's two SL2s in them. One of them is going to be the tangent. It's what? Yeah, it's the usual, so you're going to write a usual metric. In terms of the components, I'm writing it down here. So you can view this action in this language as E wedge F plus lambda E cubed. This can be rewritten in terms of, let's say, an SL2C Chern-Simon. So if you just take an SL2 Chern-Simon gauge theory, then it will be corresponding to this in terms of the SL2 algebra, the algebra valued objects inside SL2C. So if you write SL2C as three SG2 algebras in it, and then write, call them E's and F's, and write them in terms of the group invariant inner product, what this looks like, it gives you this term. You vary them, you get the Chern-Simon action. So, but the idea is that, and that's the crucial point, you don't want to view this, you don't want to a priori view this as related to the geometry of the manifold. You want to say, well, take a three-manifold, take a connection, and just do a gauge theory. So it's trying to say gauge theory is replacing the notion of gravity. That's the point. Of course, we can reconstruct the metric from the gauge theory data, in particular in the usual way, we have the metric G mu nu is, if you write in components, you have something like this. You can rewrite the metric in terms of the one-form data. It's reconstructable. At the classical level, there is no difference between the Einstein's equation and saying classical equation to this Chern-Simon. This difference comes about in the context of quantum theory. Do you view the quantum theory of gravity as this theory integrated over A tilde, or an Einstein action integrated over the metrics? Then they're different. So once you say the quantum theory is this or that, you then have given a definition of what the quantum theory means, and they're not necessarily the same. So the hope was that this is a better definition to try to quantize than giving the metric theory version. Just like a connection does, just like no more than the fact that it's a connection, nothing else. It's just an ordinary gauge theory. The identification with metric becomes afterwards, so to speak, and it's only at the extreme, at the classical level. So this is to say, basically, in fact, let me say it a bit better. For a generic gaseous configuration, there is no such metric, because it could have, if you try to write down, for example, A tilde equal to zero, trivial connection is a perfectly good point of connection. It's the usual point of expansion. That will certainly not be an acceptable metric. Okay, so certainly the fluctuations near that is not a valid fluctuation of metric. But the point was that in the context of gravity, all we know is a semi-classical state, and we don't know what the quantum theory a priori should be, so we have the liberty. We take the liberty of defining the quantum theory any way we want, as long as it gives us the classical theory correctly, which in this case it does, it gives you the Einstein's equations, then who says what is the better theory, this one or integrating over the metrics? That was the view that Witten took as to defining a quantum theory of a three-dimensional gravity in this way, using Chern-Simons theory. A similar thing can be done in four dimensions. In fact, you can do many different dimensions, but let me just talk about in four dimensions. In the four dimension, you take A to be a connection, which you identify later with the self-dual part, the SU2 part of the SO4 holonomy. So if you take a four-dimensional manifold, you have an SO4 holonomy, you have SU2 left, SU2 right, and this A is going to be one of the SU2s. Let me call it the self-dual one. It's going to be a one form with values in SU2 adjoint. There's also going to be some two forms, so this is going to be a two form on the manifold with values in the adjoint, again, of SU2. So again, it's a triplet of these. So if I want to write in terms of physics notation, you will have something like this. And there will also be a function on M which belongs to the symmetric product of adjoints, which is traceless symmetric product. Traceless. So this is the five-dimensional representation of SU2. And the action is, again, I'm not going to worry too much about signs and factors of two and so forth, but something like this. The trace of F wedge sigma. So these are two forms. This F is the connection. F is the curvature associated to A. So trace of F wedge sigma minus sigma wedge sigma. You can put lambda over just plus. So again, you put a trace here, plus theta AB, sigma A, sigma B, so if you take this action, and if you vary with respect to the connection, and with respect to sigma, and with respect to theta, you find that this is equivalent to Einstein's equations in four dimensions. So this purely gauge theoretic object is equivalent to the Einstein's equation, and this is one of the starting points of loop quantum gravity in trying to quantize gravity in terms of gauge field. Let me just write this here. So you get the equations that sigma is covariantly constant two form, and FA is lambda sigma A plus theta AB sigma B. And you get another equation. The equation with respect to theta, the variation of the theta, gives you the condition that sigma can be viewed as a basis of self-dual two forms. So the triplet of sigma has a structure that can locally look like this, plus the other two. Now, if you vary that, you get the traceless, the condition that sigma A, sigma B, the symmetric traceless part of it, the zero, implies that you can write it in this way. So this condition guarantees that you can view this as a space of self-dual two forms. It's compatible with the fact that this covariant constant with respect to the A, which was the self-dual part of the connection. And this equation turns out to be related to Einstein's equation, the curvature part and the cosmological constant part of the Einstein's equation. And this theta turns out to play the role of the self-dual part of the wild curvature tensor. So it's an unfamiliar way, perhaps, of writing it, but it's equivalent. One can show it's equivalent to Einstein's equations. It's quite remarkable that the metric, in this case, the four-dimensional metric, can be written in terms of this data in a nice way, in this case in terms of sigma, viewing the sigma as a space of self-dual two forms. You can write the formula, and the formula turns out to be relatively simple to write. Sigma mu alpha, sigma nu beta, sigma zeta gamma, ijk. So there's SU2 indices, and there's the space-time indices, the four indices here. The mu runs from 1 to 4, each one of these lower indices. So you contract these four indices here, alpha, beta, zeta, gamma. The fact that I have one epsilon tensor means that this is the right density object with the squares of G on the left. And you can check that, well, you can check explicitly that this is the same thing as saying that sigma corresponds to space of self-dual two forms. But again, you see that this is a composite object, and the fundamental object has now become this form together with this other connection which satisfies these equations. I want to also point out a particularly interesting set of solutions to these equations which turns out to be relevant for us, and that's the case where theta is zero. If theta is zero, these are what are called anti-self-dual Einstein manifolds. So they satisfy the Einstein equation, but it's anti-self-dual. The anti-self-dual part vanishes, of the curvature vanishes. And this turns out to play a special role for us, as I will mention later. So these anti-self-dual Einstein manifolds. Well, you can have, for example, S4. What was that? I didn't see. Yeah, S4, for example, is an example. Okay, so I talked about the dimensions 3 and 4. And again, you notice I talked only at the level of classical equations. I haven't talked about the quantum theory. And I'm going to continue that now with dimension 6. Now, in the context of dimension 6, I will not spend too much time. I'm assuming this is workshop or conferences on topological strings. This dimension 6 is a particularly familiar one to most, if not all of you. So I'll be brief on it, but just to set the terminology. In dimension 6, we talk about, specifically about the Calabi-Yau threefold case. One could try to generalize it, but let me just stick to the Calabi-Yau threefold. And there are two kinds of topological strings we can talk about, the A model and the B model. In the A model case, we are counting the holomorphic curves. Or according to what mathematicians call computing Gromov within invariants. And this object, at least perturbatively, responds to the Cayley class of the Calabi-Yau. What I mean by response means that you have to choose the Cayley form for a Calabi-Yau threefold, and when you're counting a holomorphic curve in a given class, you weigh it with the area. So you pull back the Cayley form and integrate over the Riemann surface when you're trying to weigh it. So the partition function of the topological A model will depend on the Cayley form. On the other hand, in the B model case, you're trying to describe the variation of the complex structure of the Calabi-Yau, and it will depend on a holomorphic three form that is denoted by omega. And as is well known, these two things are related by mirror symmetry. where you replace one manifold by its mirror manifold and going from Taylor to complex variations. Now, there's more to the story, and I want to bring it out because it might be relevant for my later connection I want to point out, is that these theories don't have just the closed strings that I would describe here in terms of holomorphic curves, but you can also have D-brains. If you put D-brains here, you put Lagrangian D-brains. So you talk about holomorphic curves ending on Lagrangian D-brains. So this will have Lagrangian D-brains. So you can talk about the open version. Here, you will have holomorphic D-brains. So dimensions 0, 2, 4, and 6. So the holomorphic D-brains. And something funny has happened here, as you notice. We were talking about the A model, which counts holomorphic curves, but somehow the count of the corresponding D-brain, which are holomorphic curves, is one of them, and points and so on, is part of the other model. And this is not by mirror symmetry. And also, in the context of the A model, when you talk about holomorphic curves, they end on Lagrangian D-brains, but Lagrangian D-brains are three-dimensional objects which respond to the whose volume is related to the integral of omega over them. So it seems like the D-brains of the theory somehow get mixed up in the wrong way. What would have naively been the A model brain has ended up the B model and vice versa. A priori, there was no explanation here, just as a curious fact. Okay, let me move on to here. Now, why are these gravity theories? Well, the three and the four dimensional example I told you were clearly some gravity theory, at least classically they were solving. They could be reforming that solving some gravitation, some metric equations. Why are these gravity theories? They are gravity theories precisely because they arise in a closed string theory. That's the first answer. Namely, anything you're doing with closed string theory is abstractly a gravity theory. Well, a little better answer to the question is that, well, after all, it depends on Kähler form. Kähler form has the information about the metric of Calabi-Yau. So the classical theory involves understanding of introducing a Kähler form, and so this is doing something involving gravity, some kind of a Kähler gravity. So this A model can also be viewed as something which I could call Kähler gravity, which is not the ordinary gravity. It's not the ordinary Einstein's theory in six dimensions, but something involving restrictions to Kähler class, restrictions of the metric to be Kähler. How do you quantize it? Well, I don't have to think about it too deeply because somehow string theory tells me how to do it. String theory, at least perturbatively, is instructing me how to compute it. Here's the answer. So string perturbation theory tells you how to compute the amplitudes of this Kähler gravity theory. So string theory has come up with this simpler gravity theory in six dimensions, which somehow can be labeled Kähler gravity. It quantizes Kähler forms on a Calabi-Yau. It is not equivalent to ordinary Einstein's theory in six dimensions, but could be viewed as some baby version of it, namely when you restrict the metric to be Kähler. And the B model is a mirror of it. So B model, if that's called Kähler gravity, this could be called some complex gravity or what's called Podara-Spencer gravity. So it's doing the same thing, but instead of varying the Kähler structure of the Calabi-Yau, it's varying the complex structure. So roughly speaking, if I talk about the Kähler form, you choose a closed 2 form, 1-1 form. In this case, you choose a holomorphic 3 form. So you can view these solutions to be related to solving these equations with the appropriate charge condition on omega, omega being a 3-0 form in that case, and k being a 1-1 form. I won't go into too much detail on these, on the six-dimensional case on topological string, because I'm assuming that's the point which is most studied by the string community, and a lot of you here are familiar with the topological string, so I will not belabor that too much. Any questions? Yes.
The
That's a very good question. So let me, in fact, it's related to what I need later on, so let me actually explain a bit more. So when I talk about the Kähler form, I could talk about Kähler form or equivalency, and it turns out to be important for me to talk about the score of the Kähler form, which is a 4 form. So when you talk about the Kähler form or its square, the K-Wedge-K form, there's a cohomology part to it. And then there is a part which is not cohomological. So in other words, you can take, write this as some kind of a 4-form class plus something which is D of something 3-form. It turns out when you write the corresponding string field theory, I mean, you can write the string field theory, you get the Kähler gravity which only has this non-cohomological piece as dynamical, and the cohomological piece is frozen. It's not dynamical. So indeed, you're right that the Kähler form is not dynamical, but the precise Kähler form you choose, not its class. Its class is not dynamical, but the precise form you choose is dynamical, and that's precisely what are the propagating modes of the topological A model when you write a string field theory action. Is that clear? So that's an important point, actually. So the cohomology class is frozen, but the class, that the exact form that you choose is not, and that's what the string theory integrates over, the fluctuations over it. That's true both also for here, namely here, you have some kind of a 3-form whose class is fixed, but you can write it as D of a 3-form, you can write it as some 3-form, fixed 3-form, plus D of a 2-form. And it's that 2-form that's dynamical in the collider sensor theory. So this is what we call the zero modes and the massive modes. The zero modes, which are these cohomology modes, are non-dynamical in this gravity theory. You have just given once and for all. And then you integrate over all the other ones. It's roughly speaking, you choose the size of the manifold, and then the rest of it, the fluctuation and so on, you integrate. Okay, now I come to the seven-dimensional one, and that connects to beautiful work done by Hitchin. So there's a notion that perhaps is not familiar to physicists. It's called the notion of stable p-forms, which I have to explain. So this concept is not new. It's known to management for a while, but let me explain what the idea is. You take a p-form. Let's just talk about some kind of a P form, something which locally will have something like E2H EP, plus whatever things which have involving these P forms. And the question is there any set of P forms which can be viewed as being generic? So if I give you a P form, what does it mean to be generic? Well, if you take a P form, you can change coordinates, and then if you are in N dimensions, then GLN will act on it. So if you look at the p-form, just choose one of these p-forms, let me label it by a point, so this is the space of all the p-forms. If you choose one of them, then the GLN acts on it, and in principle moves it to some other p-form by the GLN action. The condition of being stable means that the GLN action, when it acts on it, covers an open neighborhood of that point. In other words, if a p-form is called stable, if any p-form near it can be reached by a GLN transformation. This is what in physics we call generic p-form. In other words, the notion of genericity makes sense. It's amazing that in general it cannot be made sense out of. The notion of genericity cannot be possible, and that's easy to do by some simple counting argument. The dimension of p-forms is much bigger than the dimension of the GLN in general. One goes factorially, one goes quadratic, n squared. GLN goes like n squared, this dimension. Whereas this will, depending on what p-form you choose, you have some p-factorials, etc. in the game. So this is generally much bigger than this space. So it cannot possibly be an open neighborhood being spanned by GLN action. So generally, for general p-form in n dimension, there is no notion of stability. But for special p-forms and special n's, there could be a notion of stability in the sense of being generic. if there is such a generic thing, then a physicist might have contemplated writing an action for these p-forms. Then it does make sense that you don't have to put any restriction. Just say, okay, choose any p-form. Okay, choose a generic p-form. If you choose a generic p-form, generic enough p-form, then GLM could say that there's nothing special about it. All of the other ones are reachable by some GLM transformation. Therefore, it does make sense to write an action principle for it in those cases. Otherwise, if it wasn't generic, then you would have to put some extra conditions of what does it mean, which leaf do you choose, which particular p-form you choose, which is a bit artificial. So from a physicist's viewpoint, precisely having a notion of stable p-form is a situation where you would have liked to have if you were to write an action principle for p-forms. So an amazing statement, and it's not that difficult, is to classify what are the possible stable p-forms in various dimensions n. And I won't give you the full list, but I want to point out one particular case, or maybe a few particular cases of it. So it turns out that in dimension 7, I'm not changing notation, I guess I've called that n instead of d, that d is the same as n there. If dimension d is 7 and p is 3, then the notion of stability exists. Namely, if you took a generic 3 form in 7 dimensions, GL7 action acts on that generic 3 form and gets it to any particular point near it. So you get an open neighborhood of that point by GLN action, by GL7 action. And the stabilizer of it, you can count by counting the dimension of this group, 49, minus the dimension of the 3 forms, and the difference of that is precisely 14, which is dimension of the group G2. So out of nowhere, just popping and just counting dimensions, you're coming up with this amazing structure and having to do something with G2, and in a very special situation having to do with the notion of stability. Another special case of this, which is relevant for the A and B model I talked over there, is in dimension 6, and if you choose P to be 3 or 4. So 3 forms or 4 forms. So in this case, if I talk about A model, you take K which K, that's a 4 form. Or in the case of the B model, you take this one, it's a 3 form. Again, the notion of stability does make sense for these two cases as well. Now, this fact was used by Hitchin, in other words, the fact that there's a notion of stability for 3 forms in 7 dimensions, to write down an action principle in terms of a 3 form. So you take a 3 form, so a 3 form in the manifold, in the 7 dimensional manifold, you write some action principle, which has the property that if you take the variational principle for it, you find the extrema of it, this will give you phi, the 3 form being viewed as the associative 3 form, for a G2 metric on N7. This is remarkable. From a physicist's viewpoint, this is telling you that if you want to construct a G2 holonomy metric in 7 dimensions, there is a very particular tailored action just for that particular kind of metric. Very bizarre, but very amazing statement. That just for G2 holonomy metrics, you can write a specific action whose extrema just gives you G2 holonomy metrics. As you know, for a G2 holonomy metric, there's a particular 3 form which locally characterizes the G2, and it's given, it corresponds to a 3 form, which is called the associative 3 form for that G2 metric. Another way of saying it is that the metric can be written in terms of this associative 3 form in the following way, that square root of G mu nu is equal to phi, let me just change notation, GAB is probably better, ACD phi B ES phi GHJ epsilon C, D, E, F, G, H, I. So basically you contract these seven indices with this epsilon tensor, and the leftover two indices is the two indices of this G, A, B. This is identifying for you the notion of a metric in terms of a tree form. So you give me a tree form, phi, I write down for you this combination which defines for you the metric. This is the statement of associative tree form being related to this metric in seven dimension. Yes? You're given a topological M7. But given this, you can construct a metric, and a metric on M7. Right. So if you have a stable tree form, and stable means that basically the determinant of G in this case is good and positive and all that, from stable tree form, you can construct the notion of a metric on M. And when it satisfies the variation of the, some variational principle, in other words, when it's a solution to these equations that Hitchin wrote, it gives you indeed a G2 metric on M7. Yeah, topologically. So you think about M7 is given to you with some probably differential structure, whatever. So I'm not worrying about M7. M7 is given to me. But what I'm worried about is the notion of metric on it. Let me explain a little bit more about the action. So what Hitchin writes, the action is extremely simple and elegant. It is the integral of phi wedge star phi. It's just the norm of phi, what would have been thought to be the most obvious thing you could write. Now, this might look at first sight a bit trivial. How could you have taken norm of this tree form and call it an action? And in fact, if it weren't for the fact that this star is defined in terms of the metrics that have been told to be trivial, it's precisely the fact that this star depends on phi is what makes it non-trivial. So basically, that's the action for Hitchin. It's very highly nonlinear, and the nonlinearity of it is hidden in the fact that the star is defined relative to phi itself. Now, when Hitchin varies this, he fixes the class. So he fixes the class of this in H3. So this is fixed. He doesn't vary this. But he varies that phi in that class. So in other words, you can write phi as some fixed phi naught class plus d of some 2 form. And when he varies this, the action, he's basically fixing the cohomology class, but varying the 2 form, the exact piece of it, in order to find the action, in order to find the solutions to the G2 metric. And from here, it's not too difficult to see that if you verify, well, perhaps not obvious, but it turns out that it's symmetric and you can vary this or that. So when you vary this with this writing as d of beta, if you vary beta, the equation you get is d of star phi is 0. And of course, by construction, the way you're taking phi, d phi is also 0. And that's exactly the equivalent to the condition for phi to be given as an associative tree form for a G2 metric. Yes? Yes, I should have said. So we are taking phi to be a closed tree form. And we are varying not only in the closed class, but in the fixed cohomology class as well. So the variation is only with respect to the exact piece. Any other questions? This is index three. Index free. Well, you have to do some operation to define G, but of course I can define this, what I told you in terms of mathematical operation of some actions of some forms, right? Phi is a tree form. and contracting with epsilon, I can give it a meaning. So I can say in terms of phi acting on some linear space and dualizing and all that. So I can rephrase it, if you wish, without forms. But to do it, I need a few lines to state it. This is the fastest way of saying it. In fact, Hitchin didn't write these indices. If you'd like the index-free notation, look at Hitchin's paper. Fitzgerald preferred this way of writing. Hitchin also studied a notion of a Hamiltonian flow. So he basically takes the seven manifolds to have the topological structure of having a six manifold times an interval. And he wanted to view this interval as like a time. And the idea was that he wanted to have beginning with some data on x6, he wanted to evolve the time dependence so that you automatically get G2 metrics on this full seven-dimensional manifold. So cones or some geometries of a six manifold which is varying over some interval. And he wrote this nice Hamiltonian system. For doing that, he basically wrote his three-form phi suited or written in terms of this decomposition in terms of a three-form which is purely in the x direction and a two-form where's dt. So basically you decompose your three form depending on how much of it is along the x direction. So you end up with the data of a three form and a two form here. Or equivalently in terms of the star phi, you will have the notion of a sigma, a four form on x, plus what we call rho hat wedge dt on x, a three form on x. So the way you view this is the following. If you indeed had the product structure with the flat metric, so if you think about x as a Calabi threefold times time, which is a special case of G2 Hamiltonian metric, then this would have been a solution if you identify sigma as k wedge k and k as the Kähler form and rho as being the real part of the holomorphic three form and rho hat as the imaginary part. But in general, this does not have to be a Calabia, this x6, in which case this will rho and k will begin to depend on t. So we found the t dependence in such a way that the full thing will be a metric with a G2 Hamiltonian metric. So basically, in physics language, what you would say is that he took this action and he did the Hamiltonian quantization in this particular geometry. He wrote down in terms of time and so forth, and he identified what this Hamiltonian is. And I will write it briefly what it is. At least schematically, I'll write what it is. So he found the Hamiltonian, which involved some function of rho and some function of sigma. And moreover, this rho and sigma were conjugate variables. They didn't commute. And somehow this was like a kinetic term and this was like a potential term. More precisely, if you write sigma as some fixed cohomology class 4 form plus d of a 3 form, and again if you fix rho as some fixed 3 form plus d of a 2 form, he introduced the notion of a bracket between them, some kind of a Poisson bracket, which is the integral of gamma wedge d beta. So you take the exact pieces of them and you wedge one of them with the d of the other one. So he introduced this Poisson bracket, and with respect to this Poisson bracket, he got the Hamiltonian flow, namely ddt of whatever you want to have is given by the commutator with Poisson bracket with h. And this gives solutions to his equations, Hamiltonian flow to his equation. Now, the reason I want to point this out, why is this relevant for us, is this amazing fact that in the particular case that you had this decomposition in terms of the Calabi times the interval, these two pieces would have been thought about as the holomorphic 3 form, in this case the real part of the holomorphic 3 form, and the square of the Kähler form. So in the case that you have a Calabi times the interval, this would have looked like an object for the A model, and this would look like an object for the B model. But the A and the B model don't commute in the language that Hitchin is talking about. Namely, the Poisson bracket is not zero. So if you had a situation like Calabi times an interval, and you want to say, I want to fix the Kähler and complex structure to be this, maybe you're asking too much. They don't commute. Classically, you can fix it, but somehow it might suggest that when you replace the Poisson bracket by commutator, they don't commute. So quantum mechanically, maybe it's wrong to talk about Calabi, Kähler, and complex structure as independent and fixed. Note another fact is that this is the way Hitchin approaches his action is very much like what appeared in topological string. Namely, in topological string, you fix the cohomology class and vary over the exact piece of the cohomology class. You take a closed form and you vary over the exact piece, and that's exactly also what Hitchin does. Hitchin does not vary over the cohomology class. The cohomology class is fixed, exactly like what should happen in the topological string. Are there any questions? Yes. Yeah, you have to put H equal to 0. That's one constraint. There's another constraint I didn't write down, which has to do with some property of the fact that this Kähler form should be compatible with the complex structure coming from rho. So there's another condition I didn't write down. But yeah, so there are some things I'm not explaining. For detail, you should look at Hitchin's paper. He's written in great detail all these conditions. Okay, now I think I've set the basic parameters of the game on the board as far as the examples I want to concentrate. Dimensions 3, 4, 6, and 7. And the question is, should we expect any relation between all these? Is there a unified picture where all of them fit together? So first I want to give hints why that should not be that unreasonable. So these are hints. Now the hint I want to present is to try to first connect the seven-dimensional theory with the six-dimensional theory. In other words, the topological strings and its connection with Hitchin's system. We are already seeing one big hint here, that the Hamiltonian for Hitchin's system somehow seems to be comprised of the A and the B model as kinetic and potential terms. But there's more to the story. So what are the other ones? First, and I think probably the most important one, is holomorphic anomaly. What is holomorphic anomaly? Well, this is probably a subject not well known to mathematicians, but it's known to physicists, and it's one of the key facts about the topological strings, especially for the B model description of topological strings, unavoidable, that the answer for topological string depends on a background. It depends on which complex structure you're expanding about. It's as if the space is, the parameter space is doubled, naively. So there's this equation called holomorphic anomaly, which captures this background dependence of the topological string answer. So this was discovered by Bershadsky et al. Now, there is another way of rephrasing or interpreting this holomorphic anomaly equation, and this was what Witten did. So Witten interpreted the holomorphic anomaly equation as the statement that the topological string partition function is not a function, it's a wave function. In other words, the state in Hilbert space. And why would that be relevant? Well, it turns out that the background dependence, which is this holomorphic anomaly equation, is the same statement as saying which basis do you choose in your Hilbert space to write the state in. So the choice of a state to write the state in is the background dependence, and it satisfies the holomorphic anomaly equation. More than that, the holomorphic anomaly equation is the following state. You want to choose a basis for the state which is as holomorphic as possible with respect to choice of different backgrounds. And that maximally holomorphic basis satisfies this holomorphic anomaly equation. So the topological string function is a wave function, but wave function is usually associated to a boundary of the manifold, one lower dimension. So how could the topological string partition function be a wave function? It must be the boundary of some one higher dimensional theory. So this already, and this was already a hint, in fact, Witten pointed, so this is already, what is the seven-dimensional theory? So already it suggests that there is a seven-dimensional theory with a Calabi-Yau or whatever at the boundary and the wave function on it being the topological string wave function. So already the first hint that we go exactly one higher dimension to seven. That's one hint. The second hint is S-duality. I mentioned the curious fact, in fact it's on the board here, up here, that the D-brains of the A and the B model somehow play the reverse role, namely the D-brains of the B model are holomorphic curves and higher holomorphic dimensional objects. But the D-brains of the A model are three-dimensional Lagrangian subspaces which naturally respond to holomorphic three-form, or being, whose volume is measured by holomorphic three-form. So there was this reversal of this, and this was interpreted as suggesting an S-duality between A and B model. So S and, not, and this is not mirror symmetry. Namely, there was a conjecture that A and B model are S-dual. This is what I conjectured with Naitsky, and we found some evidence with Nekrasov and with Uguri why this might be the case, where the S-dual object interchanges worksheet on one language to the D-brain on the other. So the S-duality inverts the string coupling constant, taking the worksheet of the A model and becomes the D-brain of the B model. This also was consistent with the fact that the D-brain, the topological A model seem to be counting D-brain states, D0 and D2 brain and so on. This is what goes on, the, I guess, in this context, what mathematicians call in the context of Donaldson Thomas theory. Is a manifestation of the fact that the worksheets of the A model, which are curves, are counted by D-brains related to bundle objects, which sheaf-like objects involving D0 and D2 brain corresponding to some particular Chern classes. So that was a hint. Now, S-duality mixing A and B means A and B cannot be fixed together. Now, if you look at Hitchens' action, Hitchens' seven-dimensional action, the A and the B model could not be specified simultaneously. One or the other, kinetic and potential, are there. You cannot fix them together because they don't commute. It's very much like electric-magnetic duality in four dimension. You cannot fix E and the B together. There's an S-duality between them. You can go from one to the other. S-duality goes E to B. What's kinetic goes to potential. It reverses them. Similarly, here it was conjectured that there's an S-duality, and this would be compatible with having a seven-dimensional theory. Next was the idea that M-theory and type to a superstring have that kind of relation. Namely, if type to a string lives on m, m table lives of m on m times s1. There's one higher dimension here. So if you embed this in the context of superstring, look at the topological sector of it, the topological string theory turns out to be related to some specific computations of the superstring theory itself. So you could as well say I'm doing some superstring computation on M when I'm doing topological string. And you would ask, okay, what is M theory seeing it? Well, M theory doesn't see M. M theory sees M times S1. So from the M theory perspective, there must be some analogous theory going on a seven-dimensional manifold. So here, if you're doing a six-dimensional one, here you're expecting a seven-dimensional structure. And finally, with ideas related to black holes, that you will hear about from Hiroshi and from Mina in this conference. And this idea of black hole made a tangential connection with this idea, and I will explain what the basic point is. Consider the topological B model. It depends on holomorphic tree form. You could have defined the notion of anti-topological B model as depending on anti-holomorphic tree form. Of course, they're complex conjugates of one another, so there's not much difference between them, except by complex conjugation. But in the context of connections with black hole, it turned out that there's a deep connection between counting the entropy of four-dimensional black holes and computing topological string amplitudes, roughly a relation of the form, the position function of the black hole is the norm of the topological string squared. And this was viewed as giving a non-perturbative definition to the right-hand side. In other words, defining this as going beyond the genus expansion of topological string. Namely, you want to say, what is the topological string beyond counting genus by genus? The statement was, it's given by the black hole entropy. Yes. Yes, correct. This is for four-dimensional extremal BPS, charged BPS black holes. So the partition function of those black holes in some mixed ensemble was related to the topological string amplitude squared in the work we did with Strominger and Uguri. And it turns out that this structure, the fact that you don't have just one copy of topological string, but also its complex conjugate, is crucial. You cannot talk just about the topological string. There is no non-perturbative completion of topological string. If you ask, what is the non-perturbative definition of Z topological, that's the wrong question we have learned. There is no such thing as a non-perturbative completion of topological string. If you just take the genus by genus expansion of topological string and say, okay, what is this completion? That doesn't exist, but its square does have a non-perturbative completion, and this is the black hole partition function. So somehow we learned that in order to have something beyond perturbation, if you want the exact theory to make sense, you have to have topological and anti-topological version. But here it was, in the context of the G2 is not a complex manifold. The G2 is a real manifold. So indeed, it has not just a B model, not a complex model, but also its complex conjugate copy. It comes with a pair. It already doubles it as part of the data. So that doubling was automatic in the context of G2. So already another hint that in this context, going up in this one dimension, the fact that the notion of complex structure of G2 does not make sense, gets related to the fact that you have this doubling between the complex structure and anti-complex structure in order to give a non-perturbative definition of topological string. And in the context of the M-theory 2A string, we view M-theory as a non-perturbative completion of type 2A string. So in the topological string setup, it's natural to view the seven-dimensional M-theory as a non-perturbative completion of that theory as well. Okay, these are hints of why it's not shocking to propose what I'm going to propose. So, the proposal is a quantum version of Hitchens' theory exists. That's number one. This is a very non-trivial claim. Up to now, I've only talked about classical equations, and this already is a big step. Conjecture, I should say. And provides a non-perturbative completion of topological strings. Okay, more than that, it unifies all the form theories of gravity. I will say what I mean by this in a second. More precisely, the 3D theory, which I mentioned, the 4D theory, but only the self-dual part of it, and the 6D theory I already mentioned. So it unifies, just like M theory is supposed to do. So all these form theories of gravity get embedded into the context of this seven-dimensional G2 theory. Okay, I have explained connections to topological strings somewhat by the motivations and the hints I mentioned. This latter point, and in particular the connection to 3 and the 4 dimensional one, I want to now elaborate. And for that I need some key facts about G2 manifolds and what is called calibrated geometries in this context. Calibration. So, there are some specific cycles, choices of cycle, three curves, sorry, three submanifolds, and four submanifolds inside the G2 manifold, which are special, the three-dimensional one being called associative submanifold, and the four-dimensional one being called coassociative. And the property of them is that the volume of the C3 is exactly equal to the integral of phi over C3. In general, you can have a lower bound, that the volume is always bigger than or equal to the integral of phi, but for these special ones, it's saturated, this bound. And similarly, for this the coassociative one, the volume of C4 is equal to the dual of phi integrated over C4. So amazingly, these two dimensions, 3 and 4, pops in as special dimensions for G2. So associative and coassociative manifolds inside the G2 are special. And this resonates with the fact that we were talking about those two classes of examples of 3 and 4 dimensional gravity theories involving Chern-Simon and these form formulation of Einstein theory, which features in the loop quantum gravity formulation. Indeed, at the classical level, it turns out that this connection is not accidental and it is deeply related. The following fact. So let me talk about the following. You take a four manifold and you look at the space of the total space of a three-dimensional bundle on top of it of anti-self-dual two forms, or self-dual two forms. I never get that right. Anyhow, the space of self-dual two forms on it, the three-dimensional manifold, bundle on top of this M4. So altogether, you get a seven-dimensional manifold. So let me see, what do I call it? I call this manifold M7. So the fibers are this space of anti-self-dual two forms. So the theorem is that M7 admits a G2 metric in some canonical fashion, and only if M4 is self-dual Einstein. So if you want to study Hitchens' system in this context, with this assumption that there's this four manifold with this geometry, and reduce the Hitchens system to this equation, you should find solutions to self-dual Einstein's equation in the sense of form. Do you or do you not? Of course you should, because that's what I'm saying is equivalent. But actually the story is nicer than that. In fact, the form decomposition works exactly that way. Namely, in the context of the loop quantum gravity, I wrote down a formula for the metric in 4D, a formula like this. Square root of G times G mu nu was given by sigma mu nu, sigma mu alpha I, sigma nu beta j, sigma gamma zeta k, epsilon I j k. This epsilon is the SU2 epsilon, and the four-dimensional epsilon, which is epsilon alpha beta gamma zeta. So this was coming from the structure group of the gauge group SU2. 1, 2, and 3, and these were the space-time labels, so it was 1 to 4, on the four manifold M4. And in the context of the Hitchens writes in seven dimension a formula like this. So if you look at this, you see some similarities here. You see, all Hitchens, has, from the viewpoint of a physicist, you could have guessed Hitchens' formula. You see? If from a four-dimensional perspective, you say, I don't like this index structure being a gauge index and the space-time index playing different roles. So I want to have, it doesn't make sense to split up one part to be going from 1 to 3 and the other one from 1 to 4. I want all of them to go from the same index. Well, there are different kinds of indices. So you have to enlarge it to a seven-dimensional index. So take I, mu, and alpha, go from 1 through 7. And write that same formula, but then you have to combine this 3 and a 4 epsilon to a 1, 7 form epsilon tensor. And that's exactly the formula of Hitchens relating the metric in 7 manifold to the 3 form for the G2. But you see, that's a much more simpler object. A form is much simpler than an SU2 connection. In this case, it's not a connection, but an SU2 valued object. This unifies the space-time indices with the SU2 indices. So it's a very natural, canonical idea. So if the idea of a 4D metric and the SU2 plays a role, this clearly is a natural thing to do, to combine it to a seven-dimensional object. Yes? Excellent question. So when I'm talking about self-dual, I mean 4-0, or if you wish, 2-2, but not 3-1. Certainly not. And that's part of the self-duality is crucial for me. No. That's part of the reason I don't know how to apply it to ordinary gravity. I'm not making that claim. So this is, I'm saying that the Hitchens system seems to make contact with self-dual gravity in four dimensions. But one point is that the variables used in the loop quantum gravity seem to be the right variable, at least in the context of Hitchens. At least in the Euclidean context of loop quantum gravity, if you wish. So that would be that's an amazing relation, and indeed it suggests that the quantum version of Hitchens localized near the submanifold should induce a local quantum piece, which is precisely that four-dimensional quantum gravity, self-slow gravity in that four manifold. The fact that four-dimensional self-slow gravity should exist has previously been pointed out in the context of n=2 string theory. n=2 string theory has a target space which is four-dimensional and a self-slow gravity again. So again, we expect that there should be a self-slow consistent gravity theory in four dimensions, and this seems to be consistent with that same picture again. Similarly, we can do the reduction of Hitchens system in the context of, instead of co-associative manifold, we can do the reduction in the context of associative three manifold. In that context, if you take the normal bundle to be the spin bundle of the three manifold, which is four dimensional, so you take, let me just draw it. It's a good exercise. So we take this three-dimensional associative manifold inside three-dimensional manifold, and take a four-dimensional bundle, the spin bundle of M3, the seven-dimensional manifold, and this solves, you can put a natural G2 metric on this, assuming M3 satisfies Einstein as an Einstein manifold. In other words, satisfies Einstein's equation, and it is therefore consistent with the formulation. And again, you can go through the reduction, and you find that you get the variables exactly like the SL2 Chern-Simon variables that I was talking about as being reduction of the Hitchens system. So all of these are giving a strong hint that there exists a structure in seven dimensional. It is natural. It combines all these lower dimensional form theories of gravity in a beautiful way. And moreover, it makes beautiful contact with topological strings in six dimension. Well, this still doesn't prove it exists. This suggests it exists. So you could say, is there any other way to define this theory? And there is a way to at least perturbatively go about defining this theory, more or less the same way we define the M theory in the superstring, at least in certain situations. So I'll try to explain that point. So in the context of the M theory, relation with 2A, we say, well, you take M theory and compactify and view it on a circle. And if the radius of the circle is sufficiently small, then you might as well be talking about type 2A in 10 dimensions. So M theory on a circle, so M theory in 11 dimensions compactified on a circle to 10 dimensions, is the same as type 2A in 10 dimensions. And perturbation is top type 2A is good if the circle is sufficiently small. That's the usual M theory type 2A picture. We can take this as the definition of the M theory topological string. Namely, we can view the topological string on Calabia times S1, M theory, sorry, on Calabia times S1 as being related to topological string on Calabia. At least perturbatively. So if the analogous notion of S1 being small, you have the string perturbation, topological string perturbation theory, so you have a well-defined topological perturbative expansion, and you define it to be the small circle limit of this topological M theory. Is that all we can do? If that's all we can do, it's a bit boring. Well, there's one more thing we can do, which makes it not completely a trivial statement, and the thing we can do is take a circle fibration over the Calabia. So in other words, a number of G2 manifolds do admit a circle, natural circle fibration, where the circle degenerates over certain loci, over certain Lagrangian loci on the sixth manifold. So it turns out that from embedding this in M theory in type 2A, you can get a map between that. So if the circle is varying over this, so you have this Calabia here, and there will be some Lagrangian loci where the circle fibration degenerates, This turns out to be from the type 2A, from the viewpoint of embedding in superstring, turns out to be the same as putting D brains in this Calabi-Yau. So you can say, okay, if I want to compute this one, all I'm doing, at least perturbatively, is if I'm doing the A model with D brains on L. So in that way, you have at least a perturbative definition of what you mean, because we can compute topological string with D brains in them. So in some sense, this is more or less the same way we understand M-theory, well, modulo the matrix formulation. This is the way the M-theory began its life, namely it was defined via its connection with 2A strings. So in some sense, we are more or less at the beginning stage of trying to define what we would mean by a topological M-theory, again, through its connection on a circle compactification. Or circle vibration. But of course we believe the thing is more general and it exists in more general context. There are more stuff one can do, and I just want to point out before I close to one particularly interesting fact which seems to me quite interesting in its own right and worth studying, and that's the following. Going back to this example, Presumably it's unique. It's like asking how many non-partitive compositions do you have to M-theory in the type 2A string. We don't have a proof, but we think it's unique. Let me say it this way. If there were more than one, then you would have pushed it down to superstring and got non-uniqueness there too. So I think it's the same. Whatever the answer to this is going to end up being the same answer to the usual superstring. So we expect it to be unique. We don't have a proof, but that's what we believe. So let's go back to this example. We take M4. And we take a local model involving the bundle of self-dual two forms on M4. And if you put a metric on M4 and so forth, there's a natural thing we can do in the context of topological string, and well, in the context of, sorry, superstring, and that's putting brains on these cycles. So usually we put Lagrangian on these Lagrangian or associative or classative cycles, we naturally wrap brains. And when you wrap brains, you get some kind of a gauge theory or some generalized kind of a gauge theory. So if you wrap D brains wrapped around these four cycles, you get something like a UN gauge theory on this four manifold. Somewhat analogous to generalization of the Chern-Simon gauge theory to three dimensions, you get some kind of four-dimensional gauge theory on M4. Now, there are these ideas about geometric transitions in the context of topological string, and you could ask, what's the analogous notion of topological string geometric transition in this context? And it would not be surprising to have the following point, namely, in the case of topological string, what you did is, if you have a brain wrapped around the geometry, you delete that locus, and that's mathematically realized by a surgery kind of behavior, namely, you take this up, and what was filled before you don't fill the other way, which in this case just means that this four cycle is removed from the geometry altogether. It's not a good four cycle anymore. So if you do that, that means, so locally you have a geometry which looks like R3 times M4. You are deleting the point on your R3 where the M4 sits. And the geometry basically is going to be a sphere bundle times a radial direction, which now doesn't end. So basically it's a sphere bundle over M4. What is that sphere? It's a sphere of self-dual two forms. That is the twister space of M. So you get the twister space of M4 times some R. So this suggests that if you put brains wrapped around the M4, and if you believe there is an analog of a geometric transition, you end up with a dual description involving a twister space. So this would be a natural connection, perhaps, with ideas that Witten has introduced last year, that perhaps the twister space in the context of topological string makes contact with gauge theories in four dimensions, and this might be an explanation in the context of topological string of why. Namely, whenever we get a higher dimensional dual description, usually it comes from brains embedded in higher dimensional contexts, like ADS-CFT, you have D3 brains, in 10 dimensions you get ADS-CFT by exactly this procedure, deleting a locus and getting a dual description. Twister space is a bigger dimensional object, so there might be a natural explanation of it in the context of topological M-theory. So I think that there are many avenues one can take, and by no means any of us claim this is a complete story. It's barely the beginning that we think we have started here. Lots to be done and clarified and corrected, I'm sure, but I think that there is nevertheless some nucleus of some truth in what I just told you. Thank you.